Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the North Korea's failure to launch a missile in conjunction with the Day of the Sun celebrations commemorating the birth of Kim Il-sung. We will look into speculation that the U.S. has a covert program to sabotage North Korea's missile and nuclear program and speak with John Pike, one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He is the director of GlobalSecurity.org and previously worked for more than two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the Space Policy, Military Analysis, Nuclear Resource, and Intelligence Resource projects. He joins us to discuss whether the U.S. has managed to insert a kind of Stuxnet malware into the North Korean missile and nuclear program, or if Kim Jong-un is simply pushing the envelope too hard in a rush to get a long-range missile that could deliver a nuclear warhead to the continental United States. Then we'll get an analysis of an apparent shift underway in the White House, with the adults in the room beginning to take over as Donald Trump seems to have recognized the need to govern and that ideologues like Stephen Bannon offer little in that regard beyond heated rhetoric. Andrew Nathan, a professor of political science at Columbia University and the author of China's Transition, the Tiananmen Papers, joins us to discuss the Trump administration's tilt towards China and whether that means Trump has given up on working with Putin and has reneged on whatever covert deal they might have had. Then finally, we'll get an update on the referendum in Turkey, where from early returns, it appears the Turks have narrowly voted away democracy in favor of dictatorship. Henri Baki, the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who served as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss President Erdogan's new powers that will enable his megalomaniacal vision of himself as Turkey's new sultan, who can now rule until 2029. And joining us now is John Pike, one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He's the director of GlobalSecurity.org, which is focused on innovative approaches to the emerging security challenges of the new millennium. He previously worked for nearly two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the Space Policy, Cyber Strategy, Military Analysis, Nuclear Resource, and Intelligence Resource projects. He has also been at the forefront of utilizing satellite imagery to monitor worldwide weapons facilities. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pike.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you, John. And
You've got quite a lineup today.
It's
the one program.
I know. It's every day. It's the daily diet of doom. What can I say? But we do have, speaking of doom, Jen McMaster, the new national security advisor on the Fox News this morning, said that the U.S.'s problem with North Korea, this is a problem that is coming to a head. There was a lot of anticipation of a nuclear test and a missile test, and the sense that maybe, as Donald Trump had warned, that we're going to deal with this problem if China doesn't, that something big might happen. So that's led some people to assume that this fizzled missile test might well have been sabotaged by the U.S. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I think the North Koreans are perfectly capable of blowing up their own rockets on their own without any help from the United States. The problem that North Koreans have right now is they have a very ambitious strategic modernization program, both of nuclear weapons and various delivery systems. And I think they've bet on a lot of different programs, some of which look like they're going to work out, and others, those dogs just won't hunt. And I think we're seeing here one of the liquid-fueled programs that has been notoriously unsuccessful over the last couple of years.
So do you think they're just firing off this old inventory of liquid fuel because they've replaced them with the more reliable and ready for launch solid-fuel missiles?
I think that's exactly it. Of course, we don't know what they're doing over there, but the singularly unsuccessful test program they've had with their liquid propellant missiles suggests to me that they've got a warehouse full of them. They might as well shoot them off. If one of them works, great, and if it fails, not. But these are consistently blowing up shortly after launch, whereas they have a solid propellant program that works reasonably well. And with the newly reinforced operating relationship with Iran, which had just been focused on the solid propellant missiles, I think North Korea is shifting in that direction as well. And so I think they're moving away from liquid propellant and towards solid propellant.
And apparently this was, at least initially, the U.S. intelligence analysis is that this was a medium-range missile. So
that's right.
The concern is, of course, that they could get a missile with a range sufficient to deliver a nuclear warhead on the continental United States.
Well, they've had that missile for several years. And the question has simply been whether they could put a warhead on it. My own assessment is they've been able to put a warhead on it for several years. So the idea that somehow or another there is a future threat that Donald Trump is going to have to prevent, I think, is a fantasy. That threat is already here, and I don't think we can do very much about it.
And again, I'm speaking with John Pike, who's one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He's the director of GlobalSecurity.org, which is focused on innovative approaches to the emerging security challenges of the new millennium. And he previously worked for nearly two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the space policy, cyber strategy, military analysis, nuclear resource, and intelligence resource projects. He's also been at the forefront of utilizing satellite imagery to monitor worldwide weapons facilities. So then, what did you make of the parade on Saturday's Day of the Sun celebrations with these long...
All these new rockets?
Yeah, the drive-by. So
during the Cold War, when the Soviets pulled that stunt, we called it rattling your rockets.
Uh-huh.
The Soviets would drag a lot of rockets through Red Square back in the 1960s. And half of them turned out to be fake in one way or another. And I think in the case of North Korea, we're seeing a number of fake rockets to keep us confused. Some of them may be real. Some of them may turn out to be real down the road. But I think that there was a fair amount of disinformation in that parade yesterday.
Well, of course, the Soviets' Red Square parades, they would also not only have, you know, fake missiles, but they'd also fly over these squadrons of bombers, which would then do a big slow
circle
turn
around Moscow and fly over again.
Right, and they just kept coming all day, right.
It created a bomber gap, you know.
Right, right. So when you say that you think this is the idea that they could drop a nuclear warhead on the United States has already happened or is happening, and we have to get used to
it. We've been there for years, right. Several years.
Well, of course, there's always the option of coming over and taking one over in a trawler or something. I mean, there is, by and large, a greater concern about
clandestine introduction. That's certainly one option as well.
Right. So, what is? I actually interviewed on Thursday Donald Gregg, a former CIA officer who was a U.S. ambassador to South Korea, and he was George H.W. Bush's national security advisor.
Uh-huh.
He knows the North Koreans. He deals with them a lot and thinks we should be talking to them and not scaring them or trying to bluff them, because they don't bluff easy. And it's kind of a, you know, senseless posturing. So do you think that I don't see that idea of negotiation anywhere on the table. So what do you think is happening now? I started out by mentioning General McMaster's comments today on Fox News. It seems like the U.S. is pushing the envelope, upping the ante in terms of rhetoric, as opposed to coming to some kind of understanding that the Chinese can't make these people do what you want them to do. At the end of the day,
we're going to huff and puff and blow their house down.
Right, or you know, until we figure out that one of these days we're just going to have to talk directly to these people.
I think the problem is there's really nothing to talk about. The international community's position is that once the United States pulled its nuclear weapons out of South Korea, once South Korea agreed not to develop nuclear weapons, that North Korea should uphold its part of the bargain and get rid of their nuclear weapons. Well, the North Koreans have changed their mind. They think that their nuclear weapons protect them from the United States and other people in the neighborhood, and they're not going to give them up. There's no way they're going to give them up. It's not going to happen. The Obama administration's position, they call strategic patience, basically to wait them out. And I wasn't a big fan of Mr. Obama's foreign policy in other areas, but I think in that direction, they hit the nail on the head. There's just nothing to talk about. But the idea that we're going to bluff them or pressure them, I think is just going to get us into trouble. We should ignore them.
But on the other hand, my sense is that if you were to make a deal with the North Koreans, in other words, have direct negotiations, you know, technically the Korean War is still
still at war
because the armistice was never complete, or the end of hostilities was never completed.
Right.
If you were to have an agreement that ended the hostilities, wouldn't the Kim regime collapse shortly thereafter? Because one of the glue.
Well, I think you're onto something there.
Yeah, the glue. Absolutely. is their paranoia about the Americans are out to get you.
Yes, and they've got their population whipped up into this war fever that's been going on for six decades now. And I've thought for some time that if we simply walked into the truth village at Panmunjom and threw a peace treaty on the table and said, the war is over, bye, that the North would implode, or certainly would have a controlled collapse of some direction. So that would be, I think you're onto it exactly. We need to give them a peace treaty.
So back to this notion that there's some covert U.S. Ability to sabotage North Korea's nuclear program and missile program. Uh-huh. There have been a lot of hints in that direction, and some people interpreted Donald Trump's kind of confidence that we're going to take care of this problem meant that he had something up his sleeve. Uh-huh. You don't buy that, I take it.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that the North Koreans are perfectly capable of messing up their hardware on their own, and particularly over the last couple of years when Iran has relocated so much of its activities to North Korea. I think the North Korean program managers have been under a lot of pressure with this new Iranian competition to come up with something that works, and they've just been trying too hard, and the result is launch failures, like we've seen today.
So what contribution are the Iranians making to the North Korean missile program? I don't imagine. Maybe they are with the nuclear. I don't know. But
Well, they are with the nuclear as well, because North Korea and Iran have been cooperating on their nuclear programs and on their missile programs since the 1990s. And the North Korean program has just gone on like gangbusters over the last couple of years. And I think that's because the Iranians are helping them both with the nuclear program, the enrichment program, and with their missile program, because the Iranians have been concentrating on solid propellant missiles. The North Koreans have been doing both, and now we're seeing a changed emphasis in North Korea towards solid propellant programs, which seem to work. The liquid propellant programs they've been working on don't seem to be doing so well.
So what about the idea that there's some sort of Stuxnet type malware that's been inserted into the North Korean programs, just as it's alleged that the U.S. and Israel...
It was done in Iran, that's
yeah,
right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was skeptical of that initial report on Stuxnet sabotaging Iran's nuclear enrichment program. It was very thinly sourced. There was basically one guy claimed it. I've heard no credible suggestion that they're doing anything like that here. But if I wanted to get the North Korean leadership trying to track down saboteurs and spending more time searching for Trotskyite wreckers than actually trying to build the program, I would suggest to them that there was sabotage going on, because the search for sabotage wrecked the Soviet Army before the Great Patriotic War, and I think that sort of disinformation campaign that would be the way I would try to wreck their program rather than some malware stunt.
So then you're suggesting that, because it was General Cartwright who first leaked that public information about Stuxnet, and he I think he actually did some jail time and then
a few months.
Yeah, and Obama.
And there was no other source for the program. There's
right.
No other source for that story.
And Obama pardoned him. So,
yes.
So you think that you don't think there's anything to the idea that somehow.
Well, I don't know, obviously.
Yeah. Right.
But the provenance of that story suggested to me that it might have been disinformation. You only have one source. They convicted him to make him look credible, and then he gets pardoned so he doesn't have to suffer too much for playing along with the scam and taking one for the team. Is that true? I don't know. But it's not a deeply sourced story, and that makes me a little bit skeptical. And certainly in the case of North Korea, it's going to be far easier to suggest to them they've got saboteurs because they're quite paranoid, you know, as opposed to actually trying to get software into one of their rockets. Maybe we are doing that, but I think that jacking up the paranoia in the North would probably be a lot easier to do.
So what then are we to make of Vice President Pence's trip to South Korea? Do you think that this is going to sort of calm down? I mean, the one thing that I mentioned to Ambassador Gregg last Thursday when I spoke to him was about the many options that General McMaster said that that Trump had asked for and that he's
That's
given
right.
him. One of the options was nuclear decapitation or a decapitation scenario. And certainly that kind of annoyed Donald Gregg. He thought that was something that shouldn't be discussed. Had you heard anything about that?
Oh, yeah. These plans have been around for 20 years. I mean, the Bush administration thought that blowing up Iraq was going to be easy, so they came up with plans for blowing up North Korea. But then when Iraq turned out to be not so easy, they lost interest in blowing up North Korea. But those plans have been around for two decades now. Op Plan 5030, 5015, and I think that the Pentagon has just dusted off those plans and briefed them to Donald Trump. I don't think they're going to actually do anything with them.
Right, but if you were to somehow target at Kim Jong-un, what's the what possible guarantees are that his military leaders won't press the button and retaliate?
Well, it's a problem. It's
right.
a problem. You know, I think that the North wants nuclear weapons so that we won't blow them up. We should avoid blowing them up precisely because they have nuclear weapons. They're very dangerous, and we need to think about down the road possibly some sort of controlled transition in which the South goes north and the Americans exit so that the Chinese don't freak out about having American troops on the Yalu River. But I think we need to be thinking more about those managed transitions than lobbing a nuke into Pyongyang just to see what might happen.
Well, just in closing, what is Vice President Pence doing then? Is he just sort of trying to either continue ramping up the paranoia or... Because you have to imagine that the South Koreans are not too thrilled with the possibility that their capital could be incinerated.
Well, I think they're not terribly thrilled. I mean, social media over there seems to be pretty riled up about it. I'm sure that the Russians have been jacking up their social media to get them even more riled up about it, and maybe the Chinese too. But I think he's over there to take their temperature to see what they have to say.
Well, John Park, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with John Park, who's one of the world's leading experts on defense, space, and intelligence policy. He's the director of the globalsecurity.org, which is focused on innovative approaches to the emerging security challenges of the new millennium. And he previously worked for nearly two decades with the Federation of American Scientists, where he directed the space policy, cyber strategy, military analysis, nuclear resource, and intelligence resource projects. He's also been at the forefront of utilizing satellite imagery to monitor worldwide weapons facilities. series. We're going to take a brief station break and back getting an analysis of an apparent shift underway in the White House with not just putting the adults in charge, but perhaps a tilt in favor of China.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Nathan, a professor of political science at Columbia University, where he teaches where his research interests include Chinese politics and foreign policy, the comparative study of political participation and political culture, and human rights. He's the author of a number of books, including Chinese Democracy, Popular Culture, and In Late Imperial China, The Great Wall and the Empty Fortress, and China's Transition, the Tiananmen Papers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Nathan.
Thank you.
And I guess the broader question here in terms of who's up and who's down in the White House, which does seem to be something of an obsession on the part of the process-driven Washington press corps, and of course the daily sort of follies of Sean Spicer seem to certainly capture a lot of attention. But it does appear that the adults in the room seem to be taking over, and that the ideologues like Stephen Bannon, who offer little more beyond heated rhetoric, seem to be marginalized or in the process of being marginalized. So do you think that just in terms of the ship of state, do you think that Donald Trump has come to the realization that he has to govern, and the people that help him govern the adults in the room?
Maybe. He flips and flops. People say that he listens to the last piece of advice he got, and the last major piece of advice that Trump got was actually from the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, who was able to brief Trump on things about Asia that apparently Trump didn't know.
Like what?
Like that, well, according to a remark by Trump himself, he learned from Xi Jinping that China doesn't have as much influence over North Korea as Trump had imagined. And we don't know what else went on in those conversations, but if I would imagine that Xi Jinping might have explained to Trump that, for example, the U.S., since Nixon visited China in 1972, has recognized that there is but one China and Taiwan is a part of that China. He might have told Trump that a peaceful resolution of the Taiwan issue is being prevented by U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. He might have told him that everything was peaceful in the South China Sea until Hillary Clinton interfered, stuff like that. And since Trump apparently didn't know those things, he would be hearing the Chinese side of the story from somebody who probably is very persuasive.
Well, is there then still a kind of battle line between the American firsters, the isolationists like Stephen Bannon, and the sort of neocon Lazarus, the zombie neocons that have somehow making their way back, because they've always wanted to gin up some kind of arms race with China. And much of what's happening with North Korea seems to me to be overheated. And, you know, this pathetic country, this paranoid country, Your colleague there at Columbia, the historian, says
Charles Armstrong.
Yes, he refers to it as the tyranny of the weak. And here we are, you know, our hair's on fire over this, you know, little fat boy and shooting off his missiles, you know.
There is an argument to be made for letting North Korea develop its missiles and nuclear weapons and then using the good old classic method of deterrence to make sure that they don't use it. There's an argument to be made for that, but I don't think it's politically acceptable. It wasn't acceptable in the case of Iran. And yet this may be what ends up happening because we don't have a way of making Pyongyang give up the nuclear weapons. And I would imagine that Xi Jinping explained to Trump that the reason North Korea is developing these weapons is that the United States has threatened the existence of that regime consistently since 1950, and that they are doing it to protect themselves. And Xi probably told Trump, if you stop threatening them, sign a peace treaty and give them a security guarantee, then there might be some chance for them to give up their weapons. But again, this is not something that Trump or really any other American president, I think, could accept. It would mean accepting a nuclear North Korea that's run, as you said, by the little fat boy whom we don't trust. So, you know, it's a dilemma. But probably my guess is that, you know, there is no solution to that problem. We will end up in a posture of deterrence against North Korea.
Well, you know, unfortunately, U.S. foreign policy doesn't lend itself to subtlety. And during the Cold War, of course, a few people, I remember speaking with Paul Nitzer about this, that a few people inside the government put forth the notion of the Soviet Union let them suffer from what they call geostrategic indigestion. In other words, let them take over Africa. You know, just stop being so paranoid about the Russian empire, the evil empire, and the more they take over, the quicker they'll collapse, and which is exactly what happened. So if North Korea and the U.S., in the unlikely scenario that they were to sign a peace treaty, that would be the beginning of the end of the Kim regime, surely. I mean, without the paranoia of the Americans are coming to attack us and this militarized society that they run there, wouldn't that take away their raison d'etre?
Well, I think the ideal situation for that regime probably is to get a peace treaty with the United States, not to disarm itself as we demand, but to still have its arms, and then to tell the people, I mean, it is risky. I mean, that regime is at risk because most of the population lives in poverty, but they've been amazingly successful in controlling the population and controlling information. So I agree that if they took a Chinese policy of the open door, they would have a hard time surviving. But could they get a peace treaty with the United States and maintain their isolation and their totalitarianism and then play between the U.S. and Beijing, you know, getting concessions from each side? That might be ideal. Right now, the North Korean regime feels that it suffers from Chinese domination. You know, they're smothered by China, they think. They're threatened by the United States and smothered by China. They have nothing but enemies. So if there was an opening to the United States, it would alleviate some of their strategic anxiety. But I agree, they wouldn't want to then go capitalist or open up or liberalize the domestic regime, because then they'd be overthrown.
So let's go back to the idea that maybe there is a tilt towards China. Of course, we all remember the pivot of Barack Obama's to Asia and the TPP, which was designed to isolate China and put leverage on China, which, of course, the first thing that Trump did was take that away, which is a huge gift to the Chinese. He doesn't recognize that, though, does he, that was a gift to the Chinese?
I don't think he, I don't know, but I, apparently he doesn't recognize it.
So am I just assuming that, that he, as you say, the last person he talks to is the one that influenced him the most? And if he was really influenced by his conversations with the Chinese leader, that doesn't necessarily mean that the Trump has figured out, well, we're better off dealing with the Chinese and let's forget the Russians, you know, and whatever secret deal I might have made with them, I'm going to renege on.
You mean with the Russians?
Yeah.
Golly, that's, of course, I'm, I like to tell people, I don't understand American politics. I deal with the simple cases like China, you know, because I don't know what, of course, what secret deals there are with Russia or, for that matter, with China. The Chinese are very transactional, as is Trump, and very pragmatic, and they have a great deal of money. So they can help Trump in his public policy by investing in the United States, by purchasing, you know, saying we're going to purchase X amount of some American product, whether it's apples, airplanes, soybeans, steel, or whatever. It's easy for them to spend money publicly, and they can also do it privately, and there are many ways for them to benefit the Trump family and Trump retainers. I'm not saying they're doing it because I don't have that information, but it's something that they could do, and
sure,
they have a lot more spare money than Russia has.
Right, and we know that Trump's, I think, his first priority and his obvious focus is being a businessman. Yeah, and he's never been a politician. He's a businessman first. And I think whether he's doing it intentionally or not, he is running the country like a business and making money.
It looks like that, yeah. And I think that really plays into one of the strong points of the Chinese leaders and the Chinese economy. They have, you know, $350 trillion of foreign exchange. They're looking for places to invest. They're investing all through Central Asia, all through Europe, and really everywhere in the world.
Right. So it's not then a zero-sum situation vis-a-vis the Russians versus the Chinese like it was under Nixon, where he played the Chinese off against the Russians, and the U.S. was in the catbird seat.
So under Nixon and after, until the end of the Cold War, there was the strategic triangle, and the Chinese were the Soviet Union and the United States were the two superpowers, and China was sort of the asset in play between them, and as such, China benefited a lot from the strategic triangle. Today, again, you have three sort of major powers that stand out above all the other powers, although Russia really is the weakest of the three, but sort of punches above its weight because of its strong military and because of Putin's daring use of what he has. So, and right now, the strong leg of that triangle is really the China-Russia strategic partnership, which took shape in order to try to check American post-Cold War sort of triumphalism. But it seems to me quite fluid. At this moment, it looks like the U.S. is the odd man out, and Trump's reboot with Putin has failed, and that he's softening on China. That's the picture today, but it seems to me it's quite fluid because there are always profound tensions between China and Russia. They share a very long border. They have a tormented history. They really cannot help each other much with anything except checking the U.S. They compete for influence in Central Asia. China really is the stronger of the two. So I think there is room for more surprises, perhaps. I don't think that, but I dare not to predict firmly what they might be. But if I did, they wouldn't be surprises. But the possibility of Trump or some American president trying to wean Russia away from its partnership with China over an issue like terrorism, or by yielding the Russian what they want, sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, that kind of thing. I think that potentiality exists.
Well, there was a speculation that the choice of Tillerson, as a former head of Exxon, who'd already made deals with Russia over exploiting Arctic oil and Siberian oil, that there was some kind of suggestion there that maybe what Russia wanted was to get the U.S. technology to develop that oil and pipe it into Asia and create the same kind of leverage that with the Asian markets that they have over the Western European markets through Gazprom.
Yeah, that's a great point. So Trump's, by the way, earlier you mentioned that Steve Bannon's, the decline of Bannon's influence might be connected to Trump's warming up on China, but it seems to me that the main anti-China guy in the Trump apparatus was Trump himself. I don't know that Bannon cared a whole lot about China.
No. Well, Peter Navarro is the nutcase that's really absolutely obsessed with China, and I think he's just so loony that they've even had to marginalize him.
I don't know why he came into the whole administration, but he seems never to have exerted much influence.
Right.
And I mean, as a businessman, Trump, there's so many things he said in the campaign that he obviously didn't believe. They were just good laugh lines in a way. And China, 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 45% tariff is probably a thing that even as a businessman who doesn't know much about Asia, that he would have perhaps never taken seriously, I hope.
Well, but you know what it was. It was appealing to the blue-collar vote in the Rust Belt, and it worked. He won
exactly
those three key states that Hillary Clinton should have won and blew it. So, and I'm sure, you know, that was it. Bash the Chinese, blame your unemployment and downsizing on American unions and the Chinese and outsourcing, et cetera. So, well, just in closing then, so you don't see then anything, I mean, can they ever make up for the loss of the TPP? And because, again, that was such an extraordinary gift to the Chinese. It's hard to believe that somehow somebody hasn't pointed out to Trump that you know, that the whole idea is to get the neighborhood that's concerned about China, particularly its aggressive moves in the South China Sea, to work together. But then he just blew up that whole agreement, with all of those Asian countries and the Asian Pacific countries as well. That that's in tatters, and China is right back on top of the heap.
Right. It is possible to revive the TPP, and I would think if they did it, they would do it under a different name. Seeing Trump's modus operandi, he would create something with a completely different name and say that he had invented it himself, you know, kind of thing. So that's possible. As to whether they're going to do it, I really can't say, because I have no information about that. I would assume that the, as you said, mature people, the adults in the administration, are looking for an opportunity to propose that to him. All we know now is that he has tweeted about a trade deal with China. What is a trade deal with China? I don't know. China and the United States are members of the World Trade Organization. There hasn't been any negotiation between the United States and China for a free trade area or something that you would call a trade deal. So I don't know what that refers to.
Well, Andrew Nathan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Nathan. He's a professor of political science at Columbia University. He's the author of a number of books, including Chinese Democracy, Popular Culture in Late Imperial China, The Great Wall and the Empty Fortress, and China's Transition, the Tiananmen Papers. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll get an update on the referendum in Turkey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's Policy Planning Staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it looks as though the yes vote in the referendum in Turkey has narrowly won. At this point, what are the latest? Do you know, Henri, in terms of the percentage?
It's very confusing because the results are being contested in the sense that it's not clear whether or not the Supreme Electoral Council has officially announced them because the way the Turkish system works, I mean, they announced a number of the percentage of ballots boxes that have been opened, and there seems to be some disagreement as to whether or not those numbers are correct or not. This election, I mean, Erdogan will probably claim, I mean, he has already claimed victory, but this is a really dark day for Turkey. This is the first time since 1946 that a Turkish election or referendum has been marred by suspicion, by a really very large cloud of suspicion, and the results are going to be seen as being illegitimate, and I think this is not the victory that Erdogan was hoping. He invested a great deal into this. All of the state resources were poured into supporting his position. People who were opposed to him were not allowed to campaign. They were not allowed to put posters up. They were accused of being traitors. They were accused of being supporters of the West, supporters of to all of Turkey's enemies. So under these circumstances, it is the fact that the no vote is so high. I mean, and this is the acknowledged no vote. There are also enormous numbers of videos coming out where very suspicious activities were observed, like officials stamping ballots in favor of the government, and so we don't know how extensive some of these suspicious activities were. But whatever it is, the fact that this is a razor-thin majority, the fact that people don't trust the results, the fact that with all the pressure, the no vote managed to be so large means that in reality, probably the no vote won, and Erdogan knows it. And this is not going to be easy for him. I mean, he will make the most out of it, but the fact of the matter is that he's going to be an illegitimate president, and that's going to cast a shadow over his presidency.
Well, clearly the coup, or the aborted coup, failed coup that took place recently, indicated resistance to him in no uncertain manner, but it ended up backfiring in his favor.
Well, I wouldn't put too much credence on that coup. I mean, that coup was not very extensive. That coup was done by very, very few people. In fact, there were very few soldiers who were out on the streets at night, and most of them thought they were going on maneuvers. They didn't realize they were engaged in a coup. That coup is very suspicious in terms of its origins. We do not really know who instigated it, despite what the government says. So that coup was not the result of some popular movement in Turkey. But you're right about the following, that he used and milked the coup to essentially maneuver for this referendum result. I mean, all of the campaign by the government was also based on, if you want to support the regime against those who wanted to do a coup, then you vote yes, although the logic doesn't make sense. Nonetheless, I mean, they milked the coup, and in general, the people's opposition to the coup as a means of getting support for the referendum. And even, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up, in a sense that you've had this amazing gift from God, as Erdogan said, in terms of a failed coup, and yet with the legitimacy that was conferred by the coup, he still couldn't get a resounding victory here. And four of the largest cities of Turkey voted against him. And so the countryside votes are very suspicious, because there was no, in many places, the only poll watchers were members of the AKP, the ruling party, Erdogan's party. And look, one of the most important opposition leaders is in jail. He's in jail in trumped-up charges, as I think 10 other members of parliament from his party. There's 150 journalists in prison. Hundreds of journalists have already been fired, and all of course, opposition journalists. Newspapers have been taken over. The press is 90% controlled by Erdogan, directly or indirectly. With all these advantages, he still could not get a resounding resounding yes vote. I mean, I thought that he would not be able to cheat in a massive scale, and that the no vote would eke out. I wrote in a Washington Post column this week that there is a tendency among Turks that when somebody tells you have to do this, they vote against you. And we've seen this historically in many after coup attempts, or after successful coups. Every time the generals took over, in the first election after the generals decide to leave power, people vote en masse against the party that was seen to have been victimized by the coup attempt. And in fact, Erdogan, to some extent, owes his own success at the polls in the early 2000s to a military intervention in 1997 that got rid of the party that he was associated with, but then he broke away from it and kicked that party out of power. So Erdogan's victory in some ways was helped by the military's missteps, mm-hmm. right? But mm-hmm. the reason is because people don't like interference in the politics. And a lot of people who may have been sympathetic to Erdogan, who may like Erdogan, still voted against him, I think, including members of his own party, because they probably resented the way they were pushing this vote down people's throats.
What about then the dispute over the unstamped ballots? You mentioned earlier, probably in the rural areas. And by the way, that sort of makes me think perhaps there is some analogy here with the United States, because there's no question that the American people in the urban areas, they vote Democratic, and in the rural areas, they vote Republican, and the Republicans have massively gerrymandered. Is there a case that you have sort of the red state versus the blue state dichotomy in Turkey, as we have here, where the more religious, less educated people voted for Trump, the strong leader, the man on a white horse, and likewise it's happening today in Turkey?
No. I mean, first of all, in the United States, there is no fraud. in elections. I mean, Trump won because he won the majority of the states with the requisite electoral votes, even though Hillary got 3 million votes more than he did. But that's the way the system works here. And I think the comparison would be unfair to the United States because here we have no example or proof that there was any vote rigging or anything like that. In Turkey, too, historically, there's never been any vote rigging. Never. I mean, I've always thought that the one thing that the Turks have gotten right consistently was their electoral system. And it was an electoral system that everybody trusted. Nobody ever questioned it. I don't remember elections being questioned like this, like they are being today. Right? So, and then another reason, by the way, the comparison doesn't fit is because in Turkey you have this ethnic division, and part of the rural areas, the Kurdish areas, voted against Erdogan. But there are many reports, even from the Kurdish regions, where village headmen essentially blocked their constituents from voting and voted for them. We don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot of contestation in the weeks to come. It's not going to change anything because the government won't let it, won't allow it, because, you know, this is a do-or-die issue for this government. They cannot accept the fact that they obviously cheated. But in any way, the fact that the atmosphere in which this referendum was held was blatantly unfair. When you were being accused, if you wanted to vote against, you were accused of being a traitor to the country. You were accused of being siding with the West against Turkey, or siding against Turkey in allegiance in cahoots with the PKK, with the all kinds of enemies, Daesh. I mean, anybody whose enemy they decided was fair game in terms of using it as to denounce the opposition. And when you don't let opposition leaders campaign, right, and when you don't let the opposition put even signs up, and people get arrested for putting no signs. I mean, that's not a fair election. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, and remember, that creates an atmosphere of intimidation because people, you know, even people who want to vote no may go and cast a spoiled ballot or vote yes because they're afraid, because they think that somehow the government will know how they voted. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the fear of the government, the almighty state, I should say, is actually quite prevalent in Turkey. So, you know, this is, I mean, the other problem for Turkey, or for Erdogan, I should say, is that, he can try to convince and the Turkish public that this was a fair and, you know, he wanted clean and fair. Nobody in the rest of the world believes that.
Sure.
Right? So he's, I mean, next time he sees a European leader or an American leader, or anybody, he's damaged goods.
Right. Well, of course, he stoked anti-European fervor, and a lot of the people that voted for him were angry at the outside world. So I don't know how that can turn around. And I take your point that there's no comparison in the terms of the elections between the U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and Turkey. But is there a comparison though with Donald Trump and Erdogan in terms of their massive egos? I mean, this guy, Erdogan, seems to be a total megalomaniac, and he sees himself as Turkey's new sultan, and now he can rule until 2029.
Actually, longer than that. There's a loophole in that constitutional referendum that allows him to run, actually, at least until 2033.
Hmm.
So in fact, it's very carefully, this is a loophole that many people missed. And there are a couple of very interesting loopholes that expand his powers in ways in which the Turkish public did not pay attention to. I mean, some of them look minor, like two words in one article of the Constitution that completely change the balance in terms of one of the institutions that respond to, that is under the control of the president. I don't want to go into the details. It's kind of in the weeds a little bit. But so there are many loopholes, And one of them is the fact that he, although he's limited to two terms after 2019, the loophole allows him to actually run for a third term under certain circumstances, which he will definitely avail himself of. So he's going to be there at least until 2033, which means that he probably will be in power continuously in Turkey for 30 years, from 2003 to 2033. That's 30 years. That's going to be most Turks will have lived under him and will have known only one leader. And that's what he wants.
Well, just in the last minute then, Henri Baki, I'm astounded, though, that people in Turkey, I mean, I know this. You're suggesting that probably more people voted against him than they voted for him, but because of how he controls the press and they stamped out the opposition, he can rig the vote for the first time. But nevertheless, in the broadest sense, his policies have failed. He started out with a policy of zero problems with neighbours. Now he's got nothing but problems with neighbours. His policies towards Syria are completely failed. His military adventurism has failed. Now he's got more jihadist cells. He let them in, and now they're blowing up all around the place in Turkey. He's got fights with his neighbours. He started a war with the Kurds again, and he's also driven down tourism. It's a decline by 30%, and that's a big source of revenue. So I'm just astounded that people can't. And this guy says he's going to, no, you vote for me, and things will get better, and the economy will get better. Well, he's.
Here's, I think, the mistake that people will make. Erdogan is also genuinely popular because he actually, especially the first 5 years of his rule, between 2003 and 2008, he ran the country admirably. I mean, he did everything right. He, in terms of domestic reforms, in terms of making life easier for Turks, especially in healthcare, I mean, his reforms really changed Turkey. I mean, I thought, you know, in 2008, if I was a Turkish citizen, I would have voted for him too, because, I mean, he genuinely improved a lot of this country. And Turkey also has grown tremendously in the years he's been in power. It's not all due to him, because the reforms that were introduced before he came to power helped him a great deal. But at least he didn't mess up those reforms, which other Turkish politicians have done routinely. So he took an economy that was on the brink of a breakthrough and helped it along. And in terms of infrastructure, he's done a great deal. I mean, we should not underestimate his. And look, the fact that the Syria policy is a failure, for everybody. It's not just Erdogan. It's for Obama, Trump is too early. For everybody has lost in Syria. It's a no-win situation. So we can't blame him for the Arab Spring. And at the beginning of the Arab Spring, he seemed to be on top of things. Did he make mistakes? Of course he made mistakes. But what happened is that after 2008, that's when his megalomania starts to appear, and he seems to think of himself as essentially a leader of the Turks forever. And and it's true, we're going to see from now on an attempt by him to actually try to increase his influence abroad, especially in the Middle East, try to become, assume the leadership of the Middle East. But this referendum is going to really taint and it's going to hamper these efforts.
Well, Henri Baki, I thank you so much for joining us here today. And again, I've been speaking with Henri Baki. He's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars. He served as the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.